This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. Alabama's prison system is, by some accounts, the deadliest in the nation. 15 inmates died by suicide there in 15 months, from December 2017 to this March. The homicide rate inside this system is 6 times the national average. This is all according to a recent report by the Equal Justice Initiative, a nonprofit based here in Alabama that helps the wrongfully convicted. Devin Hill spent 2 decades in this state's prisons. He was released this year. Here's how he described his time in prison.
It's probably worse, you know, because when you're living in it, you don't even really understand. Like between a week's time, it might have been 8 stabbings. You know, you understand? Only when you see it on paper do you realize, wow, you know, because it looks so bad on paper. You realize, is this violent?
The U.S. Justice Department has repeatedly condemned the conditions in Alabama's prison system. This April, a new report on the men's section of the system condemned it for widespread violence, sexual assault, overcrowding, and understaffing. How did things get so bad? And what can be done about it? Let's discuss it as part of our special project 1A Across America, a collaboration with 6 NPR stations to highlight more local and regional perspectives. Teresa Holmes is the mother of Matthew Holmes, an Alabama prison inmate who killed himself in February. He was incarcerated at Limestone Correctional Facility in Harvest, Alabama. That's the same place where prisoners went on a hunger strike this summer to protest inhumane conditions. Teresa, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First of all, I'm very sorry about the loss of your son. How are you doing these days? You all right?
I'm holding in there.
Yeah.
I am.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Can you take us back to how you found out that your son, Matt, had taken his life?
I actually found out the morning after. Another inmate's wife had contacted me and told me. I never found out from the prison itself.
The prison never contacted you?
No, sir, they did not.
Take us back to that conversation. What exactly were you told about that it happened or even the circumstances?
I had gotten a text from another inmate's wife asking me had the prison contacted me. And this was the morning of the 15th. And I had told her no. And she asked me to call her. I called her. And she again asked me, are you sure the prison hasn't called you? And I told her no. Why? What was going on? And she told me that, she said, I hate to be the one to tell you this, but Matt killed himself last night. I went from there and contacted the prison, and they phone bounced me from person to person to person, and I finally got in touch with the warden. And all he could say to me was, all I can tell you is your son took his own life last night. And that was it.
He said it just like that?
Yep, just like that. And said that that's all he could tell me because it was under investigation. Then he did say that he put me on hold and came back and did say that they tried to contact me, but they didn't have a good phone number, which is definitely not true. My phone number hasn't changed in 20 years.
Tell us about Matt and what his life was like before and during prison. Why was he incarcerated?
Matt was incarcerated for a robbery conviction in 2010. Matt was a good kid with a good heart. He did get mixed up with some kids and some things outside of home that took him down the wrong road. Inside prison, Matt grew up, unfortunately, inside prison. But he had made a lot of accomplishments. He had recently gotten a electrical tech degree. He was on president's list, dean's list, and he was enrolled for a special program at the University of North Alabama when he passed away.
Were there any signs, Teresa, any clues that Matt might have been considering taking his own life?
I talked to Matt 5 days before he passed away. And he was quiet. I don't know what was going on. I didn't know what was going on. And he was kind of quiet. And within a 5-minute call, my son told me 6 times that he loved me. And the last time he told me, he said, "You remember that?" And I asked him, was he okay? And he told me yes, but something inside me knew something wasn't right. But from past experiences, I knew that if I called up there to ask somebody, they would just tell me, "My son's a grown man. They can't talk to me about it."
Wait, I'm sorry. What does that mean when they say your son's a grown man? Like, he should be able to suck it up and handle it?
More or less. Or, you know, he had had a medical thing going on a few months before, and I had made a phone call to ask why he hadn't gotten medical attention, and that's more or less what I was told. That they can't discuss that with me, that he is a grown man.
Had he ever talked to anyone within the prison about the possibility of him killing himself? I understand he spent some time in solitary confinement. Is that right?
Yes, and he had discussed that. Matt has tried suicide before, and they knew this. Matt was a mental ill patient. He was placed on mental health observation before they put him in segregation. And he was in solitary confinement when he took his life.
Can you point to, in retrospect, Teresa, any maybe one or two main factors that played the biggest role in your son taking his life, either something that was done, not done, done wrong, done too late? What do you point to as the biggest factors in all this?
They do not take into consideration that the mental ill in the prison system, they need treatment. They need the attention, and they're not getting it. My son was on mental health observation and was taken out of there and placed into segregation, and him telling them that what he was going to do. And from me talking to other people that were in there, he was begging for help, and they refused to give it. And from what I'm told, he was told to go on and do what he was going to do. So he quit kicking the door.
I'm sorry, wait. So he would quit kicking the door? Explain that.
He was kicking the door, begging somebody to come help him. He was telling them what he was going to do. And they allowed it to happen.
Just to kind of shut him up?
Yeah, I guess.
Teresa, we want to talk with our panel about what can be done to improve what's going on in Alabama's Department of Corrections. It seems like more and more Americans are more compassionate these days to the plight of people behind bars, that more people are saying, yeah, we need to do something about this. Doesn't make sense to people on any side of the political spectrum. What would you say to the Alabama Department of Corrections, to Alabamians who are listening to this, about what needs to change? What message do you have for them?
Well, I can say, you know, my son, like many others, fought and still fight daily to be treated humane. They're denied proper medical and mental health care. But unfortunately, my son lost that battle. They need to put more effort into making sure that these inmates get the proper medical and mental health care. And I made a promise to my son after he passed away, and I tend to keep my promise that I will do everything in my power to make these changes happen so that this doesn't happen to another inmate, so that another mama don't have to go through the pain of losing her son or daughter.
Teresa, I know this is really hard to talk about. It's hard to hear. Certainly not as hard to hear as it's been hard for you to deal with. We are really grateful that you are willing to tell your story. Teresa Holmes is the mother of Matthew Holmes, who took his life in February while incarcerated at an Alabama prison. Teresa, all the best to you. Take care of yourself, and thanks very much for sharing your story with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's continue the conversation here at WBHM in Birmingham. Joining us in studio is WBHM's health and science reporter, Mary Scott Hodgen. Mary Scott, welcome.
Thank you.
Senator Cam Ward is a Republican in Alabama State Senate, where he chairs the Judiciary Committee. Senator Ward, welcome.
Thank you.
And Carla Crowder is the executive director of the Alabama Appleseed Center for Law and Justice. She spent more than a decade representing people incarcerated in Alabama's prisons. Carla, thanks for making time for us.
Good to be here.
Could I start with you, Carla, and just your reaction to Teresa's story? Is her story unusual in any way?
Her story is tragically not unusual. Just this year, there have been 22 deaths, either by suicide, overdose, or homicide. The deaths continue unabated, even despite the Department of Justice findings that Alabama's prisons are unconstitutional. We have to look back 40 years because that's when this started. The federal government first had to take over our prisons from 1976 to 1989. Our state officials have known our prisons were underfunded, overcrowded, understaffed, and dangerous for decades, and that's led to the lack of services and mental health care, of medical care, and the lack of staff that pay attention to the cries that people like Matt, they cried out for help and they were ignored. And we hear that is happening every day. It is really hard for the federal government to find a prison system unconstitutional. The standard is not real high. But in Alabama, we've been subjecting prisoners to conditions that pose a substantial risk of harm as our regular practice since the 1970s.
Senator Ward, what was your reaction to this report from the Department of Justice? Did it surprise you at all?
When I was first elected to the Senate in 2010, one of the issues taking on as chairman of judiciary was the prison system, the correction system. And it does anything but correct. There's nothing correct about the correction systems. It's a reactive agency. It's not proactive. And as Carla said, you know, you mentioned that maybe it's one of the most dangerous prison systems in the country. I would say the stats show it is the most dangerous. And it's heartbreaking because you hear those stories all the time, in addition to the high suicide rate, which unfortunately I think goes underreported, as well as the violence, inmate on inmate, officer on inmate violence, which definitely goes underreported. Those stories have become so too common. And I think sometimes what is a little scary is that we may desensitize ourselves to it and think, well, this is just the norm. It's the way it should be. But it's hard not to hear that and not have some sort of emotion about it. And at the same time, other stories like that, including parents and families being extorted from other inmates, you know, threatening violence on another inmate or threatening to harm their loved one if you don't send money. So multiple stories of death, suicide, violence, it really is throughout the entire system.
Mary Scott, could you zoom out a bit and talk about the larger reputation of the prison system? We've been talking mostly about the men's prison system. DOJ has also had a fair amount to say about the women's prison system. So this problem seems to be pretty global as it relates to the Corrections Department in Alabama.
Yeah, well, this recent DOJ report was strictly about the male facilities, but it's true that in 2014 there was another DOJ report specifically about the large female facility that we have in the state called Tutwiler. And that specifically detailed acts of sexual abuse and harassment, specifically staff on inmate. And in 2015, the state came to a settlement with the DOJ about that report and worked through it to, I think now they've complied with, they said, 41 of 44 orders from the DOJ. And, you know, one thing to note, though, is that report about Tutwiler was about one facility, whereas this most recent one is about, you know, systemic issues within all the male prisons. So it's a much, much larger animal, so to speak. But certainly these issues have been around for a very long time and noted by the DOJ for a while.
I should note we did invite the Alabama Department of Corrections to make someone available for this conversation. They told us that no one was available, but they did provide a statement. The whole statement is on our website, the1a.org, but it reads in part, quote, "We remain in a difficult position with limited resources, which impacts both the speed and intensity for addressing long-standing issues," unquote. Before I get your response to that, Senator Ward, let's listen to one of the voicemails that landed in our inbox.
My name is Mona. I am an outside organizer with Unheard Voices of the Concrete Jungle, an organization led by inside organizers. Right now, these organizers are pushing against false narratives, such as the one Senator Cam Ward is attempting to sell to the public, that new prisons are necessary for rehabilitation programming. The guys inside know exactly the failures of the current programming and assert that infrastructure or prisons aren't going to magically bring the true rehabilitative programming, which the ADOC and politicians have always neglected and failed to invest in. We're organizing to stop the new private prisons that would only be built with the intention of housing our children and grandchildren.
Mona, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Worth noting that Alabama's Governor Kay Ivey proposed building three new prisons to address overcrowding at a cost of about $900 million. Senator Ward, the state government has a direct connection to the prison system's resources and how they're spent. What would you say to Mona?
Well, first of all, I don't think construction by itself is the answer. And if you anyone who says, let's just build our way out, that's the false narrative. Now, I will say I've been to every prison in this state. I had my most recent tour of Holman, and I think some of the reports that some groups have released showing the conditions inside those facilities, you wouldn't put your dog in there. And wires hanging from the ceiling in Holman Prison, sprinkler systems and fire alarm systems that don't work so that people just have to holler fire down the hall because the building's so old and outdated. Tutwiler, which was built during World War II, I think the key, though, is on construction that you're building for better conditions to house mental health staff, health care staff, but you're not trying to build your way out of capacity.
I'm sorry. I know we got to pause in a minute, but I don't want to blaze past something you said. You said that the system is so bad that if there's a fire, no alarm that goes off. Somebody's got to yell fire.
They yell down the hall to each other because the building is just in such bad repair. So my argument would be not that we need to build our way out of this problem. My argument would be, build to the current capacity if we have to, but make sure we have buildings that have functioning sewer and water, functioning electricity, and at the same time provides facilities where mental health can be treated. I mean, mental health is the driving issue of our prison system, and if we don't have that treatment opportunities, you're never going to solve this.
I want to talk more about solutions when we continue with Alabama State Senator Cam Ward, Carla Crowder of the Alabama Appleseed Center for Law and Justice, and WBHM's Mary Scott Hodgen. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from The Real Real, the leading reseller of authenticated luxury consignment. Shop luxury clothing, accessories, and fine art at unreal prices from your favorite designers like Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Cartier, and hundreds more. And The Real Real authenticates each item to ensure it's guaranteed authentic. Shop in-store, on the app, or at TheRealReal.com and receive 20% off select items with promo code REAL.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Back now to our conversation with WBHM Health and Science reporter Mary Scott Hodgen, Alabama State Senator Cam Ward, who chairs the Alabama Senate Judiciary Committee, and Carla Crowder, Executive Director of the Alabama Appleseed Center for Law and Justice. Glad to hear some of you who shared your stories about dealing with the prison system, including here in the state of Alabama. Robin emailed, I am an attorney who's represented prisoners on Alabama's death row. The living conditions were absolutely deplorable, and the staffing was nearly non-existent. When I visited with my clients, we would be locked in a visiting room. It would often take hours to be released after the visit. I recall once having to use the bathroom so badly that my client started yelling at the guards to open the doors. It took 45 minutes for me to be let out. Carla, I can't hear these stories without thinking of the Shawshank Redemption. This feels insanely cruel. It doesn't just feel neglectful. It feels mean-spirited, and it feels nasty, and it feels damnable. What the hell happened in Alabama? How did it get this bad?
It got this bad because the perfect storm of high poverty, low taxes, structural racism, and permanent punishment. We have not invested in services outside the prison and mental health care. We've not expanded Medicaid. We have grossly inadequate substance abuse treatment. We have not expanded drug courts or diversion programs, except for the ones paid for by people who need them most. So our jails and prisons have become the de facto solution to Alabama's historic lack of investment in people, in services, in programs.
Well, I understand that. But that's a problem in a lot of states. And they don't have it as bad as what we're hearing in Alabama. This feels unique, even in among states who have all of these exact same problems.
Well, I think the DOJ pointed out some reasons why it's unique, and that is within the Alabama Department of Corrections, you have a culture of corruption and inability to weed out the bad actors. Wardens who have overseen mismanagement, high rates of homicide and suicide in their prisons, sexual abuse of prisoners, we don't get rid of them. We just move them around from one prison to another. And also, I can't emphasize enough the lack of funding for prisons. Our prisons have been funded the lowest in the country, and yet our incarceration rate is the fifth highest and has been for decades. So we just have refused to pay for humane, safe housing. And we've refused to hold the public officials accountable that perpetuate the culture of violence and inhumanity.
I do want to note, by the way, I know that we're talking about the Corrections Department. If you work for the Alabama Department of Corrections or have worked, we really want to hear your thoughts about this. I don't want this to just be a chance for us to beat up on people who aren't sharing their voices, because we have heard from some ADOC employees. Here's what Monica left in our inbox.
My name is Monica Mann. I was a former employee of Alabama Department of Corrections, and my opinion as far as prison reformation is that reformation begins at the top. ADOC allowed me to be harassed, bullied, and I suffered a life-disabling injury because I was a licensed ordained evangelist who actually cared about the mission statement. I was very, very, very pro-corrections. I was a team player. But that seems to be not what they want.
Mary Scott, could you respond to what we heard from Monica in terms of the steps that the Department of Corrections has taken? I mean, I'm sure the department hasn't been doing absolutely nothing, right?
Well, since the DOJ report was released, what we've kind of seen is this most recent legislative session, there was an increase to the budget for the DOC, and a lot of that was to pay for an increase in salaries for correctional officers and to hire more correctional staff. Keep in mind that they're under a court order as well, with a separate class action lawsuit to hire, I think, over 2,000 correctional staff in these coming years. So they have a lot of room to go with that. And the salary increase still keeps, like, a starting correctional officer maybe in the upper $30,000, around $40,000 a year. So the position itself, if we're talking about correctional staff, you know, those are tough positions to fill. And then if we look at what the DOC is doing, they have this four-part strategic plan. Something that they've emphasized in recent months is this increase in contraband raids at the state facilities. Some folks have pushed back on that, kind of saying, well, what happens after these raids? You know, they go in and they do get a lot of contraband, but once those raids are done, there are reports that, you know, the contraband comes right back in. So, and then the DOC is also supporting this plan to build three new prisons to address the infrastructure issues.
Senator, with regards to what else might be going on inside the prison system, Nicholas asked, what are the contributing factors to this problem? Are there more violent than usual prisoners, lack of resources, a culture of violence amongst guards? Senator, what about the culture inside the prison system?
It's a terrible culture. And I think going back to what two of my colleagues here just said, one of the biggest driving factors in that is a lack of public policy support. You know, if you're going to address the problems at DOC, there's some laws to be changed. But at the end of the day, you're going to spend money. I mean, there's just no way around not spending more money on treatment. And also, we talked about the hiring of more officers. You got to pay them more. We passed a bill this past session that would actually increase their pay, but it's the lowest paid law enforcement officer in the state of Alabama as a corrections officer. And it's guaranteed to be the most dangerous job you go to every single day. So a lot of times you're going to have some bad apples that get those jobs. But I will say this, we have to do more on the transparency of reporting and these abuses that take place.
Do you think, Senator, that Alabamians really care about the people who are in prison? It doesn't campaign well to say, let's be nicer to prisoners. Tough on crime, law and order, three strikes and you're out. That's built a lot of political careers. And I just don't know if the political will exists, not just in Alabama, but in a lot of places, to say, you know, maybe we were too hard on drug dealers, murderers, rapists, gang members, and we should treat them a little more humanely. That's a hard political sell.
You should go on my social media page. I get that hard sell every day.
I bet you do, yeah.
I was in North Alabama the other day talking and I was like, you really want to get down to fixing this? You're going to have to rally public support. And yesterday, someone told me, they said, why do you keep talking about this prison stuff? Lock them up, throw away the key. They deserve what they get. You know, the same lines. And I try to echo back why you should care. You know, the Eighth Amendment is still the Eighth Amendment. It equals every other constitutional amendment, the Bill of Rights. You can't support the Second and Tenth and ignore the Eighth. And so we try to sell that, but public support is what's going to drive changing this. If you don't have public support, your elected officials aren't going to go along with it. So it's a continuing education process.
I've seen, Senator, that there is increasingly a bipartisan argument around prison reform where
yes.
progressives and conservatives are both able to kind of attack the same problem from different perspectives with different sets of solutions that seem to interlock rather neatly. Does that exist here in Alabama?
The only way you'll ever fix this is through bipartisan support. There's no way to do it. One party, the Republicans can't do it by themselves. The Democrats can't do it by themselves. The issue is, I think there's a lot of common goals. The question is how you get there. We did that in 2015 when we did a part of the sentence reform we have now. However, it's going to take both parties. And we've had those conversations that have been going well. I just don't want to get overly politicized because, again, if it ever becomes Democrat versus Republican, the whole issue goes away, and that's unfair.
Carla?
One real challenge is that there's this narrative that exists, a false narrative, that the majority of people in Alabama prisons are violent people who should not get out. The parole board recently has clamped down on paroles. They stopped paroling people for several months. But what folks don't know, unless you have spent time with incarcerated people, is our prisons are full of folks, probably like Matthew, who got in trouble when they were teens, got sentenced for 20, 30, 40 years for robbery. I have a client who I worked with who was severely injured in St. Clair Prison. He was in what was called a therapeutic community. His name was Antonio. And he had his ear partially bitten off because he was assaulted in prison. He ended up taking programs, doing well, got parole. He probably wouldn't have been paroled but for that injury because that made him more sympathetic to the parole board. He's been out for 4 years. He's working. He's doing fine. If not for my advocacy, he would have been stuck in prison because he would have been labeled a violent offender. There are thousands of Antonios in Alabama's prisons, and we are not giving them the chance that they deserve.
And Carla, could you just compare what the typical path would be, say, for a convict behind bars in Alabama who does not have an advocate, who's trying to get better treatment, trying to get parole, trying to get to advocate for themselves, as opposed to having someone help advocate for them? How big is that difference?
There's a huge gap because the guards have so much power. They will write people up for disciplinaries. Incarcerated individuals cannot challenge their disciplinaries, so they often have to fight to save their own lives or to have enough food to eat or a place to live. There are homeless people in Alabama's prisons because someone else is living in their assigned bunk and there's no guard or staff to help them find a place to live. So people are trying to survive in those conditions. Their institutional records look bad. They go up for parole and the parole board says, oh my goodness, they got into a fight. Look, they had some contraband food. Parole is denied without advocacy, and they're set back 4 or 5 years and stuck in those prisons.
Mary Scott?
Yeah, I think I was actually at the first day of parole hearings that the parole board had last week after a two-month delay. And, you know, it is really interesting to sort of look at the questions that come up, like who is paroled? And a lot of times families and inmates they try to present, you know, I've participated in this program or I've gotten this certificate. But also, you know, you have to remember that our system doesn't have a lot of, we lack programming and we lack mental health treatment, we lack drug treatment. So, you know, and we don't have the services on the inside to prepare folks to reenter. And then once, you know, if they are released, I think they get, what, $10, a bus ticket, and a set of clothes when they leave prison, and then we don't have a lot of programs on the outside.
Yeah, to that point, can we play another clip from Devin Hill? You met him at a meeting to discuss prison reform, Mary Scott. He served 20 years in Alabama's prisons and was released this year.
Well, me personally, like, I used to be real critical of people who get out and don't prosper, you know, because I feel like you should succeed just on your will alone, but I've realized that it ain't that easy. You need a support system. I went to the career center at least 26 times. So, I mean, what about the people that don't have transportation? You understand? So, you know, I understand now why it ain't that easy to just get out and access services. You know, it take money and support for everything. So for those who don't have it, then their role will be much harder.
Mary Scott, where does that stand in terms of the state giving released inmates more help in terms of re-entering society?
Well, not much. We have a very disjointed system, as far as I understand, of any kind of community re-entry programs. They're basically non-existent. We have some programs, like here locally, the Offender Alumni Association helps with reentry, and that's really a grassroots organization started by formerly incarcerated people. So it's sort of like they're groups that have kind of come together to fill in these gaps. But we definitely lack reentry programs. And then I think on the note of mental health and drug treatment, that's something system-wide in Alabama we don't have, whether you've been in the prison system or not. So for a lot of people, you know, you think about spending 10, 20 years in this prison system that you've just heard all these horrific accounts in, and then you leave, think about the mental impact that that has on someone, whether or not they had mental issues to begin with, you know?
Senator Ward, what would an ideal reentry program look like to you?
Well, I tell everybody this. I said, look at a person the day before they're released, and they're going to look that exact same way the day after they're released. If you treat someone like an animal in a cage when they get out, they're probably not going to be a nice person. I think reentry, I think that is a huge key part of what we have to do. In addition to mental health treatment, we have to help these people reenter society. And I think something progressives and conservatives can agree on is, what do you want someone to look like? I tell you what they want to look like. Get a job, have the skills to be a successful taxpaying citizen. That means job training. That means life skills that a lot of folks take for granted. That also means any kind of mental health or drug addiction treatment. But it's a complex system. But those reentry skills can greatly reduce the potential for recidivism.
Carla?
Everybody agrees on that. So it's really confusing to advocates that the governor's office is just saying we have $900 million for new prisons, and she's not saying anything about reentry. We can look to Texas. We can look to Oklahoma, both southern states with high incarceration rates that have greatly reduced their prison populations by rehabilitative programs, by making sure people have the tools. Something as simple as a driver's license as an identification when they get out. And Alabama hasn't even started that process.
Mary Scott, one detailed question I forgot to ask earlier, but Chris, one of our listeners, was smart enough to throw it in. Chris asked how many of these prisons are privately owned prisons, and how can the state regulate them with limited funding? How much is this private prisons versus state prisons?
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but our system is, we don't have any privately owned prisons right now. There is a facility in Shelby County that I think
over
is privately
Columbia,
owned.
The therapeutic, the education reentry prison in Columbia.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but that has been a criticism, I believe, of the plan, because one of the options, I don't believe it's been finalized yet as the funding system, but that has been thrown out, is to pay for these prisons, the three prisons that have been proposed, is to do a build-lease program where a company would build them, and then the state would just lease them from that company. The state says that would not be privatization because they would continue operating the prisons, but that's been a criticism.
I would fight to the death if we tried to privatize our prison system. It doesn't work. It's never worked. Now, as far as the construction side goes, building a prison, a private company is going to build it either way. The question is, do you do it through a bond issue or do you do it through a leaseback? But I think as long as they're run by public citizens, by the Department of Corrections, that's the way to go. But I would not want to turn it over to a private company to manage and run it.
Senator Cam Ward, a Republican in Alabama State Senate and the chair of the Alabama Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator, we really appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Well, thank you for having me on this panel.
WBHM Health and Science reporter Mary Scott Hodgen. Thanks, Mary Scott.
Thank you.
And Carla Crowder, the executive director of the Alabama Appleseed Center for Law and Justice. Carla, thank you.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Avery Kleinman and edited by Miranda Fulmore. Thanks to WBHM, one of our 1A Across America partner stations, for hosting us here in Birmingham this week. 1A Across America is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.
If you start your weekdays with Up First, now you can start your weekends with us, too. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Stay caught up with NPR News 6 days a week. Up First, NPR's morning news podcast, weekdays at 6 Eastern, and now with weekend hours, too. Saturdays at 8 Eastern.
What are the things that make us human? Why are we the way we are? I'm Guy Raz. Each week on NPR's TED Radio Hour, we dive into the incredible forces that shape our very existence. Listen now.